Women's Center, Feminist, Indigenous Knowledge. So, hello, Angela Domich, there comes, did you bring our presents? Did you bring our gifts? Amiga mia, did you bring our gifts? From Colombia.
Yes.
Super, we are in very luck. We will touch her feet later. That's Angela Domich from Colombia. So the objective of our panel is to discuss this relatively new native notion of rematriation and its relevance to feminisms, and also discuss ways rematriation can contribute to concrete transformation of heteropatriarchy. Our idea is always to not just think, but to act. This indigenous concept of rematriation refers to reclaiming of ancestral remains, amongst many other things, spirituality, culture, knowledge, resources, and it's instead of the more patriarchally associated repatriation, pater, mater. It simply means back to Mother Earth, a return to our origins, to life and co-creation, rather than patriarchal destruction and colonization. It is indeed a reclamation of germination. The relevance of the panel is that it's a new concept amongst us feminists. It's yet little known, but it can be very powerful and potently relevant to both our thinking and our activism. Much of the power of this concept of rematriation is derived from its origins in indigenous feminist practice. So there's a whole blurb on rematriation with its origins and its more recent adoption by indigenous North Americans and Africans. And again, it's about reclamation or rematriation of both physical remains, spirituality, knowledge, etc. Return to Mother Earth, our origins, all that. As a restorative imperative, it's most relevant to feminists because we, like Native peoples, if we're not Native, need to reclaim our feminist ancestry, our feminist spirituality, our feminist cultures, knowledge, and control of the natural and other resources. We need to chart paths, strategic interventions, dreams, realities that are not mere alternatives to heteropatriarchal capitalisms, but entirely reconfigure our cosmos, rematriate our societies. It's not utopian, since the number of gender egalitarian and or matriarchal societies that still exist today, despite centuries of patriarchal encroachments and colonization, remains powerful testimony of the values of ancient, sacred, mother-centered, woman-centered spiritual communities across all continents, from the Akan of Ghana and the Khoisan of Southern Africa, my mother's people, to the Minangkabau of Indonesia, the Mashua and Lao of China, the Khasi and Punah of India, the Iroquois of North America, the Kuna of Panama, the Sami of Scandinavia, the list is endless. If you look, you will find. We hope this will birth a whole new rematriation movement amongst indigenous peoples especially, but amongst feminists in general as well, locally, globally. We're going to show the relevance and contribution of indigenous knowledge and foster social change based on beyond Western ways of knowing. Feminists, like Native people specifically, need to reclaim our feminist ancestry, our feminist spirituality, welcome, our feminist cultures, knowledge, and control of the natural and other resources. We need to chart paths, strategic interventions, dreams, very important, realities that are not just alternatives, but entirely reconfigure our cosmos. We hope this will contribute to this restorative and transformative imperative. So we're going to begin with Barbara Alice Mann, who's Iroquois. She's based at the University of Toledo in Ohio in the United States. She's going to speak on the rematriation of the truth, fascinating topic. She's going to be followed by Genevieve Vaughan, who is European, arguably. She is co-founder of International Feminists for Gift Economy Network. She's based in Italy, and occasionally when she's Buddhist, she goes to the United States. Her presentation I titled, because there's no title, Rematriating European Americans to the Mother. Is it good? Okay. And the third speaker is Valentina Pakentin, who's Pinar Khasi, the matriarchal people from northeastern India. She teaches at Northeastern Hill University in Shillong, India, an incredibly beautiful, powerful place. Her topic is In Life and Death, Reciprocity and Solidarity in Khasi Pinar Society. Don't say peanut, Pinar. And then I will speak very briefly at the end. Okay? Now we're going to do Barbara Mann.
Okay, you are you going to put security blanket? Yeah, do you have...
If we go to fast, just shout.
Okay, yeah, someone. excuse me, I don't know if I should stand up or not.
As you like, walk about.
As I like, I walk about a lot when I talk usually, but it's a very hard room to negotiate. All right. Bear Clan Seneca, and Native Americans, our clan is actually more important than our nation, even though Europeans go, what nation are you? That's the male identity, the female identity. All right. Europeans consider murder the most serious crime that anyone can commit, right? And you see all kinds of murder acts of Parliament, 1751, the horrid crime, and you see all the different representations of murder from European societies as the worst crime. But for the Iroquois, actually all across Native America, you know what we think? We think that the worst possible crime is lying. Lying is the worst crime. Why? Because murder kills one person at a time, right? But lying kills everything all at once. So that for us, that is the very worst crime you can commit. So we figure that the first step towards global sanity is rematriation of the truth. And rematriation, I know that the guys like to claim the credit, but Susan Dearcloud, Mohawk poet, actually is the first one around here that was using the term rematriation, and I want to give her credit for that. What she means by it, what we mean by it, is retooling culture in terms of matriarchal giving, in terms of the gift, okay? And specifically in terms of rematriation of the truth, what it means is you're taking the gift of breath, which is a gift, and you're using that breath to replicate reality as closely as possible for transmission to others. It's about telling the truth, not about inventing lies or myths that are convenient to so-called leaders. So rematriation of the truth means that everybody has access to all the truth all the time, because the only way that you can arrive at the one good mind of consensus is if everybody is working from the same set of facts and truth. But Europeans, we've noticed, have a very fraught relationship with telling the truth and with lying. And in fact, Native people generally across America identify lying as the major identifying feature of Western culture. Europeans, I know, don't think of it in those terms, but that's pretty much what we are. Europeans think of lying as something maybe a little bit annoying sometimes, but other times they think that lying is actually cute, so you wind up with things like Tom Sawyer. I remember when I first read that book, I was horrified by him because he's the biggest liar in the universe. Okay, and you wind up with things like Bart Simpson of the television show The Simpsons. It's supposed to be funny that he lies all the time. This is not funny to us, you know. We think that there are a couple basic ways to hold a society together. One way is by belonging. Cultures of belonging. Another way is fear. Cultures of fear. Cultures of belonging tend to welcome newcomers. If somebody new comes along the way, you immediately take them in, you take them in the group, you try to find out how they're more like you than not, and we have strong laws about adoption, which is that you take the person in and you make that person you. And the minute you do that, that person acquires obligations, and we're assuming that they will meet those obligations with integrity. Okay, our expectation of a newcomer, especially one who's adopted, and by the way, adoption is the granting of citizenship. It's not some little family event. It's a granting of citizenship. We are assuming that that person, first of all, is going to be treated as a birth member of the community, and second of all, that that person's going to be telling the truth to us, and we're going to be telling the truth to that person. That is the single largest expectation, because how can you meet your obligations if you're not telling the truth? Now, societies that see fear as the major tool, it's not surprising that they would be exclusive of newcomers. And you get that whole idea of self and other and newcomer and outside. You get all that from cultures that do that sort of Manichaean thing. Okay, you're the other and we're going to exclude you. And it's really interesting that in the United States anyway, even after someone is granted citizenship, the official, almost official policy, it's given kind of quasi-official color, is to distrust that person and distrust that person's motives of what's going on. I think I forgot to change Alex, isn't it? The other is rejected. The other is treated actually as a threat, and the expectation there is that that person is lying. That person is lying. That person didn't come into your culture because that person wants camaraderie. That person came into your culture because there is some secret hidden advantage that he's after, and you know what, that's probably going to be inimical to the host culture. Must watch, paranoia, right? It's not surprising to me that exclusionary societies are patriarchal by and large in nature. The Puritans, for example, of New England, who came into New England in 1620, they had extremely rigorous laws about who could come and sit in one of their towns, our land, their towns, right? And those rules were based on a big examination of the person that came in. If it was a family, it was only the man that was examined. And the city fathers, and it was always male, would decide whether or not that person could stay or even enter and go through the town. And if a person was to stay, whether or not he stayed was usually based on how wealthy he was. Some people were never welcome based on religion, based on race. Unless you were there as a slave, other races were certainly not welcome. By contrast, welcoming cultures are typically matriarchal. Typically matriarchal. And even of our Native American cultures that are not patriarchal, like the Lakota, they are patriarchal, I'm sorry, they're not matriarchal. They actually started out as matriarchal. They were actually matriarchal until the Spaniards ran with their ponies and their big lies. And it's interesting now that the Lakota, the leading edge of the Lakota, are trying to reclaim the matriarchal culture. It's a theme with them now. Now, the lie has been touted in the West since Plato, yeah? The Republic, 360 before the Common Era. I don't know how many of you have had the deep pleasure of reading the Republic, but it's an outline of the perfect society. Oh, it was the harumphful big God voice. Here's the perfect society. And the perfect society is based on what he called the noble lie. The noble lie, right? The noble lie is created to support the magnificent myths of what the culture is and what it's doing. And the lie was noble because it was a, quote, true lie. The lie is noble because it's a true lie. It has no potential for creating falsehood within the soul. This is what Plato's saying, right? And this noble lie stuff is still animating. 2,500 years later, it's still animating Western politics. Real politics is based on it. I mean, if you think, oh, real politics, that's the big way of conducting business in the world. That's all based on the lie. And in fact, I just saw a book. I saw this on C-SPAN. John Mearsheimer, who is a fairly well-known, I think he's a Harvard professor. He's big, he's influential, and he just wrote a book called Why Leaders Lie. And I was shocked when I picked up the book because I thought, oh, finally, this might be good. Picked up the book. And he is actually in favor of the noble lie. He thinks it's a good idea. Okay, now, think about the circumlocutions that are going on here. Think about what's being said. Any culture that can create an oxymoron like true lie, noble lie, yeah, white lies, and Indians always just get a real giggle out of that one. Any culture that can create that without blinking is not to be trusted, right? You cannot trust this culture. And in Native America, we learned that the hard way. In our cultures, lying is just, it's unthinkable. It's so unthinkable, we literally did not think about it. So that when somebody came up and they said, oh, well, here, we'll do this if you'll do that, we said, okay. And then we did what we were supposed to, and we looked around, they're not doing what they're supposed to, right? And since they would usually kill off or destroy enough of a group before they moved on to the next group, the word was a little hard to get forward to these guys. Hey, watch out, they're going to kill you. So this is why we wound up with about 400 treaties with the U.S. government, in which the U.S. government kept not one of the treaties, not one. Every single treaty was broken. So this is how we found out that Euro-Christians pay lip service to the idea of telling the truth, but it's really only truth that they feel obligated to tell other Christians, you know, any heathens in the crowd, they're on their own, because they're not going to hear the truth. So I think that it's not accidental that lying as a strategy is culturally tied to patriarchy. I think that is not accidental. What does lying do? It kills things by destroying trust. Think about it. It destroys your trust, doesn't it? And once you destroy people's trust, you scare the heck out of them. Once they are frightened, they're very easy to control. Okay. So if you want to make somebody hate another person, you start by spreading lies about them. You tell lies about, oh, you know, that Mexican woman, she just doesn't really want to work. She wants to live on welfare that your taxes are paying for. You're supporting her bastards. Guess what? And I heard that by different men, because guess what? She turns tricks on the side. Mm-hmm. And then those kids are going to go into the schools your taxes support, and guess what? They're going to lower the standards. Okay, hate her yet? You hate her yet? Now, when you're trying to control a population that's not even, I think I'm well past my, let's go forward here. If you're trying to control an external population, you spread even bigger and uglier lies. You really crank up the fear factor. Those people have weapons of mass destruction. You know, those people would just as soon kill you as look at you. My friend, this is a conflict of civilizations. You know, they're all terrorists. Let's kill them all and let God sort it out. And I've actually seen that on bumper stickers. Kill them all, let God sort them out. Okay. And that noble lie actually was so large that it took up billions, trillions of dollars that America needed for social programs. And people were so complicit with that lie that they actually even went over there to die for that lie. That's how complicit people wound up with that. Now, most frightening aspect of the big lie is that lies happen on levels, especially the international lies. There are levels of lies. They're nested lies, like those Russian dolls, or what do they call them, Matryoshka dolls, where you got the doll, and then there's a doll inside, and doll inside, and by the time you're done, you got 10 little dolls, and they're all in sizes going down to the little doll. They're nested lies like that. So you got the big outside lie, and the outside lies are based on which buttons you're going to push to get to certain populations, right? So the outside lie, the big lie, would be, oh, the weapons of mass destruction, and that'll scare people to death. Okay, now, if you want to talk to a specific group, let's say the right-wingers, then you'll start saying things like, we're spreading democracy. So that's a lie inside the lie. That's another level of lie. And if you want to get to the academic premise, we're saving those poor Arab women from Islam. Okay, so that one works on that level. And then you've got a lie for the industrialists, right? Oh, most of the Iraqi oil went to Germany and Japan, our competitors. So if we turn off the spigot, you have an advantage. And what happens, I have no idea what the innermost lies are for the innermost elite. I'm sure they're doozies. I don't know what they are. But one of the effects of these lies is to make everybody complicit. Everything. Right? And then you're the in crowd, and you're under the impression that you know. You know the real skinny. Oh, those other people think it's weapons of mass destruction, but we know it's about turning off the oil to Japan. So you get complicit, and you start feeling the in crowd, and you find that it's kind of fun to start oppressing other people, right? Well, rematriation of the truth, when you understand all this, rematriation of the truth is a revolutionary act, right? And rematriation of the truth is the first obligation. And I know some, let's see if I can get forward always, some like the Lakota elder here, Russell Means, he is all in favor of rematriating the culture. He's one of the big voices calling for it, but he doesn't think rematriation of culture is possible anymore in this world. He doesn't think it's possible to go back to the matriarchy. Well, I think he's wrong. He doesn't have the advantage of the prophecies that we had here in the Eastern Woodlands. And there are prophecies that come from the 12th century, 16th century. We've got a lot of these prophets coming forward. One was Sagane Dayo, 1799, the Seneca seer of my nation. Okay, so here's the prophecy. And it is after that white panther, that fire dragon of discord, has taken all the land and pushed the children's faces into the dust. After that white panther has sent the heads rolling west, okay, that's removal. After that, and they've got all the land, the great turtle, the great mother turtle, who carries us on her back, is going to start rocking the edges of her carapace, North America's Turtle Island. She's going to start rocking the edges to wash the sides of her carapace. And then she is going to flip over in the water. She's going to dive and flip, as she did once before a long time ago. And then when she comes up, all the irritants are going to be brushed off her back, and all that's going to remain are the shining people. The shining people. That means the spiritual people. And then that will be the fourth epoch, and time will begin again. It's the Ganya Dayo in 1799 said that was going to start happening in 2010. That's our prophecy. I know you always hear about the Mayans, but we said 2010. All right, now, not only is the greatest grandmother of them all taking matters into her own hand, but her daughters on the ground right now also have an obligation here. We have an obligation here, and it's to begin telling the truth the way Andrea Smith, Cherokee woman at the first plenary, tells the truth, disregarding fear, with no fear. This is the most revolutionary act of matriarchy, is to begin telling all the truth all the time and demanding the truth be told to us all the time. This is rematriation of the truth.
Beautiful. Thank you, Barbara. I wanted to let you know, if you have your stick, you can copy the both the PowerPoints and or the papers, because people have written papers while you're here. And if you don't have your stick, then if you give us your email addresses, we will send you what you want. Okay? So don't panic about taking notes. If you miss anything, it's not a worry. If you are fall asleep, it's okay. And it just needs a bit of rest, and we really don't mind. I like to nap all the time. Genevieve Vaughan is going to speak up.
We European Americans have been infected by the disease of patriarchal capitalism, and we have carried it to all the populations where we have settled. For many of them, it has been fatal. Others have adapted, but some have succeeded in defending themselves and their traditions against all odds. This disease of patriarchal capitalism hurts us as well as everyone else. It is the cause of wars and oppressions of all kinds. It magnifies racism, ageism, nationalism, religious prejudice. Let me say what I think it is. I believe it is an economic disease which originates in the merging of patriarchal values with market values, creating a link between the man at the top of the hierarchy and money. These are both false concept models of value, and they pull people towards being them or having them. They seem to offer and justify dominance, power, and the ability to judge. Bilateral exchange for money, giving in order to receive an equivalent, cancels the unilateral gift. We base the economic market on exchange and consider it to be the only economy, while forgetting that the unilateral giving of goods to needs is also a mode of distribution. Market exchange is a way of eliminating free gifts, making them valueless and invisible, while appropriating them as commodities. Whoever thought of the gift of fertile seeds until their species were privatized and free fertile seeds were replaced by commercial terminator seeds? Whoever thought of the gift of free, clean water until it was commodified and made scarce by pollution? Who thought of the gift of free housework until it began to be counted in monetary terms? It seems that the only way we can recognize the value of anything in our society is by exchanging it and naming it with money. The exchange way takes over the gift way, sometimes abruptly, sometimes by gradual encroachment. I was just thinking of an example of that is the airplane, the airlines. You know, their gifts also merged in with the market. So on the airlines, they used to give you a meal, and now you have to pay for the meal on the airlines when you go. This time when I came, they now have a place where you can sign up and pay $9 to be put in the first group that gets to board, so you don't have to wait in line anymore. So they find a little piece of gift everywhere they possibly can and take it over. For me, this way of doing things comes from the denial of the importance of mothers, mothering, and being mothered for the definition of human beings. Our society has isolated mothering in the nuclear family rather than generalizing it to society as a whole. In fact, unilateral gift-giving and its values cannot be generalized if the main means of social encounter is exchange. Because babies are born unable to care for themselves, their motherers have to give to them unilaterally without expecting a return. The unilateral gift has a logic of its own, and it creates relations of mutuality and trust. It unites people, and a syllogism is connected to it. If A gives to B and B gives to C, then A gives to C. The unilateral gift by which we satisfy others' needs also gives value to the other person by implication. The receiver is not passive but creative, and the success of the gift depends on her use of it. The unilateral gift can be repeated by the other person taking turns. That is, the other person has a turn at taking the initiative to give to the previous giver or to someone else again. This can be seen in the interactions between mothers and children, which are not exchanges, but alternations of unilateral gift-giving initiatives. Our ability to satisfy others' needs unilaterally and pass it on has been left out of our vision of the world because we base our thinking on exchange, giving in order to receive an equivalent. Exchange requires quantification and measurement and places an equation between the giver and receiver, which actually covers up an adversarial relation because each tries to get more out of the exchange than the other, not realizing that this means that each one is actually trying to get something free, that is, a gift, even if it is forced. In fact, that is what profit is. A forced or leveraged gift, which is unrecognized because it is called by another name. With the gift of their free housework, women contribute to this profit because the capitalists and corporations do not have to pay for the so-called work of reproduction. Then there are the many gifts of nature and culture that are given low cost or free, and the savings corporations make by not cleaning up their own pollution and letting nature supposedly take care of it. These gifts of profit accumulate and form capital, which is then reinvested to leverage more gifts. All of this market thinking and doing, upon which I could expand ad infinitum, makes gift-giving difficult. It creates scarcity in order to maintain control. In abundance, gift-giving is easy and delightful, but in scarcity it becomes difficult and even self-sacrificial. The giving of gifts of profit to the few takes gifts of subsistence away from the many. When too much abundance accrues in the economy, but the overage is wasted in wars and symbolic excesses. Abundance would make the population difficult to control, and people would not work for capitalists if they lived in abundance. They would rematriate. They would return to a maternal gift economy. This possibility is a real danger for capitalism, which therefore creates the scarcity which makes it impossible. The strange characteristics of the market economy seem normal and natural to us. In fact, we do not question them until they begin to make our own lives difficult. I submit that the market avails itself of the unilateral gifts of all, and that these are gifts of the maternal model. They belong to an economy of mothering, supplying needs without the intention of getting a return. Unilateral giving can be elaborated in many ways. I believe it is the basis of language, and I've done a lot of work in the direction of showing how words are verbal gifts and sentences are gift constructions. In this case, language would be virtual mothering, mothering with gifts and services in the medium of sound. Therefore, humans would be an extremely mothering species, since we do mothering not only much longer than most other species, but we do it virtually as well as materially. and we do it in language all of our lives, not just in childcare. We use it to create and communicate all our thoughts, our literature and science, but we do not recognize it as such because the mentality of exchange has wiped gift-giving and mothering out of our world picture. Instead, we are told we have inherited behaviors and inherited grammars, inherited altruism, and indeed inherited superiority. Finding mothering in language and the economy allows us to generalize it, or to say that it is already general, but unrecognized as such. It is by the return to the interpretative key of mothering and being mothered, unilateral giving and receiving, that we can begin again to understand the relational side of life. Egalitarian, non-authoritarian motherers mind read, that is, psychologically figure out, the needs of the child and adapt their gifts to the child's needs. The child is a creative receiver who, in her turn, can give to the mother vocalizations, gestures, coos, and smiles, which the mother receives and gives some more of her own. The child and the mother create moments of joint attention in which they point at parts of the world and receive those perceptions together. That is, when they attend to the same thing, they are both receivers of the same perceptual gift. In doing this, we also project the mother onto the world around us and receive this mother world's gifts of perceptions and experiences. Because we have learned to be creative receivers by having been cared for by our human mothers. The interface between ourselves and the environment is a nurturing motherly relation in which we are in the receiving role. Moreover, we preconsciously select which perceptions and events we give our attention to. That is, preconsciously, we are like a mother who selects the most important things to give to her children. So we are unconsciously, preconsciously, and physiologically ourselves, mothering nature regarding ourselves, and we also then turn this towards others. Maternal interactions, whether the mother is only one person or many, an extended family or a whole village, provide the basis for communication in the rest of life. If we say all this behavior is inherited, we cut out the social importance of mothering and unilateral giving. Then we do not use that logic anymore for understanding what human beings do. I believe we need a rematriation or a matriation, because it wasn't matriated before, of Western philosophy and science. We need to bring back unilateral giving as a basis for understanding who we are as human beings before and beyond patriarchy and the market, and act accordingly. We need to rematriate European Americans to the mother in our own society and ourselves, respect the rematriation of the native peoples to their lands and traditions, and stop the destruction of the great mother worldwide.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Thank you. Vanessa, please.
Okay, I hope I'll not take much of your time. My paper is centered on life and death, reciprocity and solidarity in Khasi Pinar society. Oh, sorry. Where's next?
Oh, it's this one.
Meghalaya, located in the northeastern part of India, is widely known for the people practicing matrilineal way of life. The Khasi Pinar and the Garo, surrounded by patriarchal cultures, are the only communities practicing matrilineal system in mainland India. This paper ponders on reciprocity, gifting, and solidarity in Khasi Pinar society. So this is the map, Meghalaya, India. Then, you know, it is located in the northeastern corner. In all human societies, there are rites and ceremonies accompanying major events in life, such as birth, marriage, and death. The Khasi saying, Hakayap Kaim, meaning in life and death, refers to the solidarity of the family, clan, as well as the village community on the occasion of life-giving and especially at the time of someone's death. With the conception, a woman is supposed to eat for the two bodies. Relatives, neighbors, and friends would feed her something so that the unborn inside her do not feel deprived by the craving of its mother. Birth of a child is held by women, relatives, and neighbors, and by a gifted woman, meaning a midwife in prison, I mean, they use. After birth of a child, both mother and child is being bathed. It's a special bathing, you know, for minimum a week, but it should go on for a month, by her mother or sisters. As the child grows, the upbringing of the child is not the responsibility of the mother and father alone. Among the Pnar, who practice the visiting husband, mother's brother assumes the role of a social father. Mothering is not limited to a biological mother alone. And though Khasi never have a commune per se, the whole community was a community in itself. So in our society, we do not, you know, motherhood and mothering is, we differentiate. You know, even others who are not biological mother, they can mother. My sisters can mother my children, or my brothers can mother my children. A Khasi Pnar ruler is known as Usim Ukumiyu, meaning a king is like a mother to look after the subjects. Marriage need not be accompanied by elaborate rituals. It may be carried out without rituals by simply informing the parents. When a couple is married through formal rituals and feasting is involved, family, lineage members, and also the whole village is involved. Clan members would contribute spick and chicken, and neighbors may contribute paddy or rice and vegetable for the feast. Sorry, I think I go too fast. When money sets in, monetary contributions from family and lineage members is received. This free giving of food, stuff, free service, money, and time away from the daily chores is reciprocated by the family when similar occasions happen in other families. Death is an occasion where all should reciprocate. In marriage, you need not, it's not really, I mean, incumbent, but when somebody died, I mean, all the relatives, all the villagers should reciprocate. While the body is in the house, because we keep the body at least for 2 nights, mother's food is offered to all those who come and share in the loss of the family. And this is borne not only by the family concern, but by the family members, lineage members, and even neighbors. In sympathy of the bereaved family, neighbors will stop going to the fields and take turns to be with the family members day and night till the body is cremated and even after it. Young boys and girls will be present in the night with the bereaved family as long as the body is in the house. Depending on the convenience of the family and lineage, primary or secondary burial takes place. On such occasion, the bones collected after the cremation are deposited in the clan ossuary. It is the family and lineage members who bore this expenditure. In West Khasi Hills, on the secondary burial of the father's mother, Kameika, each of her son's family should bring at least one pig to be feasted on that occasion. Reciprocal actions, it doesn't happen only on these occasions, but even in everyday, today life. Like, especially when you build a house, I mean, not now, you know, but in the past or in the remote villages, it still happens now. Everybody help in building a house, or when you do harvesting, or when you are sick, or, you know, when you have a bad harvest, they help each others out. And even when it comes to professional healers and masseur, which are hereditary or some not necessarily hereditary, their service also can be availed freely. But, of course, sometimes you can reciprocate by giving some gifts. Extra food is always cooked in case somebody drops in. When someone visits, it is customary to give them kwai at least. You know, that is the minimum you should give. No one waits for the formal invitation of eating with friends or neighbors. And especially no adult can let children watch while they eat. We always give. You know, we cannot just eat when we see children watching. Food, a basic needs of human, is shared with joy and open heart, and it binds the diners in a way. Reciprocity of food gifting and free service is a way of life the Khasi, and what binds them together in solidarity. But these kind of gifting practices, they have changed now, and now I'll just try to show how it is. Reciprocity and gifting is still practiced, but in different degrees and different modes at different level of the contextual situation and position of the family or individual. Kasipna gifting and reciprocity is rudely altered and compromised in different pockets of the society by dependency on money as a means of survival, as a determination of affluence and status imposing symbol. Monetary exchange was introduced just around the 16th century, but it became more so in the 18th century when the British East India Company came, because for trading, etc. But by the time when the British occupy our area, it's becoming more enforced because either British officials negotiating for land or for service or with the other contingent which they brought about with them. By the 20th century, money became important in the newfound town Shillong and to a great extent in villages too. Reciprocal gifting is carried out with money and free service providers and receivers vary accordingly. The affluence does not want to be obliged with free service, and the less affluence reciprocated in rather limited way compared to the earlier times. The have-nots and the village folk still reciprocate freely. With the introduction of modern medicine, institutional delivery becomes popular, and you have to pay. Most practices related to pre- and postnatal care for the mother and child needs cash compensation. So, you know, money, I mean, now every money talks everywhere. Marriage rituals, ceremonies, and feasting vary according to the economic status of the family and the type of ritual performed. The joy of communal cooking for feasting and a wedding is taken over by commercial caterers in the town and to an extent in the village too. But in the village I visit, you know, just last winter, it is still customary for every family in the village to contribute at least one basket full of rice, of paddy, I mean, to the wedding, to the family. A ritual specialist, whether Christian, a reverend, or a traditional priest, get the full limb of at least one of the pickle for the feast. The bonding and solidarity at times of death continues, but not as in the past. Two or three decades back, male neighbors contribute this free service by making the coffin and the woman the beautiful westernized wreath, because we don't have that notion earlier. From the flowers also, which is collected from the neighbors, but now you have ready-made coffin and you have flowers are not given for free. The giving of food has become less modest and vary according to the status of the family, but still they offer it. But nowadays what happened is that you have the paid dishwasher, the so-called professional for preparing tea and food, and in some areas, even grave. I mean, you have to pay the grave diggers. But otherwise, it's the responsibility of the locality to dig the grave. Free service practice in the past is limited at present. Even time spent to comfort the bereaved family, it become less. Funeral become expensive affair. But still then, I mean, they do contribute. All those who go to the funeral place, they do contribute something, you know. Death is an occasion not to be missed out, and by anyone who counts in the network of relatives and friends. So do death expense, expense at death ceremonies become more expensive, yet it is not borne not only by the family, but by the lineage members, also by the villagers, co-workers and friends. Reciprocal service when building a house, etc., becomes very rare. And now you hardly find healers or masseurs who will do things for free. And extra food is also not so widely done at present. So the Kasipna reciprocity in life and death, though it is not obliterated, but it is affected by the market economy. So in one way, money, it obliterates gifting of foodstuff, but it facilitates gift-giving, because many others, they just earn now. The solidarity of the family and lineage, as well as members of the community and the occasion of life-giving and marriage may have lessened, but at the time of someone's death, all comes together. So in anthropological terms, we call this gifting practice maybe as a generalized exchange, not as a balanced exchange where you have to give in exact, you know, terms. We don't have a word for gifting. We say you give a hand, you give a foot. That is the literal translation. It means you give a helping hand. So such gifting need not be reciprocated directly between the giver and the receiver. But each and every individual, each and every khasi becomes the giver and becomes the receiver from one and everybody. So when Genevieve Vaughan, she talked about the gift economy and the maternal values, I'm sure she referred to these kind of societies where gifts were given unilaterally can propagate throughout the community, creating a chain of givers and receivers who are all related to each other. This chain is broken when exchange and the market step in. That is what she just said. So in what we are doing now is that in the town, especially some clans have started again the new kind of organization where you bring the clan members together and they gather contribution, you know, and they help the clan members whenever the need arises. This practice of forming new clan organization is but a rematriation of our traditional practices into a syncretized, not like before. Syncretized means combining the old and the new, gifting practice, befitting the context and the setting we live in at present. Borrowing Newcomb's word, rematriation acknowledges that our ancestors live in a spiritual relationship with one another for thousands of years, and that we have a sacred duty to maintain that relationship for the benefit of our future generation. So in all of our cultures, there are good practices, and these need to be rematriated and propagated. Thank you.
That is incredible. Thank you. She had 27 slides and gave me a heart attack. That was excellent.
Can we have the next one, please? Brilliant.
Okay. So my mother's people are called the Khoi, and the other people are called the San, and these words Khoi and San like mean human or people. When I use the word Khoi and San together, as in Khoi San, I'm just merely referring to a collective and unifying noun for diverse indigenous peoples, a people and person belonging to and of other people. There's a Pan-African Nguni concept called Ubuntu, which Archbishop Desmond Tutu, amongst others, has made very famous. Has anybody heard of Ubuntu? Not the software, but Ubuntu, like Tutu's Ubuntu. Okay, cool. I'm very impressed with this room. I should come back again. Or the Khoisan word is Kwenya, which I find completely unpronounceable because I didn't grow up in the language, with apologies. So in other words, people's identities are rooted in their communities. I am because I belong, rather than Descartian, I think, therefore I am. Indigenous identities are perceived of as human rather than man-centered, as in the rights of man and so on. Ife Amadumi, a Nigerian scholar based in the United States, Dartmouth College, very famous for her work on matriarchies, she said, African matriarchies, when we look at women's contributions and approaches to development in Africa, we see that generally women are guided by teachings deriving from what I would call a relational matriarchal principle that sees us all as human beings and children of one mother, Umune, which is the concept she uses for Ubuntu or Kwenya. I believe this to be a general and basic African ethic of kinship. It can further be a non-racist and non-patriarchal basis for an alternative global citizenship in the struggle for human rights, social justice, and an inclusive development. So I want to emphasize, and we emphasize, the decolonizing imperative of the notion of rematriation, the act of rematriation. When we're looking at the continent of Africa, I love this map, I'm going to use it in every presentation for the next year at least. If you look at the geographic size of Africa, you see you can fit the United States, Europe, India, Japan, China, Mexico, Peru, and so on, and the United Kingdom, all of it in there, and all of that combined is still smaller in geographic size than Africa. So just to give us an idea so that we shift our thinking in relation to how we perceive of Africa as this poor little continent, when indeed it is vast, and in fact its resources are what European wealth is constructed on largely, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that is Table Mountain or Tafelberg, where the young man, handsome young man in the back, very single young man, is going to visit in October, born of a very beautiful, very good mother. And I walk that beach every so often when it's not too cold. And that mountain is about 2 kilometers high, and it's part of their ancient chain, It serves indigenous spiritual and certificate purposes like astronomy, etc. I'd be happy to show people sacred sites. And when I went to New York City for the first time, I saw the Statue of Liberty. I went to Paris for the first time, I saw the Eiffel Tower. These are just two little blue things. I always thought these places were like vast from the photographs, the imagery, and indeed from colonization. But when I was standing there, I saw the Statue of Liberty. My God, it's very puny. It's very tiny. When I saw the Eiffel Tower, I was like, what a puny thing. I thought it would be massive. But no, it puny by comparison with this massive, powerful, sacred mountain at which at whose feet I grew up. So it gives me a concrete way of understanding that I need to decolonize mindsets, consciousness, and we need to rematriate, or matriate, as Genevieve would say, an appreciation of the indigenous, part of that decolonizing of the consciousness. So Heidegüttner Abendroth edited a book which was launched in, towards the end of 2009 by Inanna Press in Toronto. It's called Societies of Peace, Matriarchies, Past, Present, and Future. I highly recommend the book. Güttner Abendroth speaks of, conceptualizes modern matriarchal studies. And you'll see there's a lot of commonality between Güttner Abendroth, who is German, and Ife Amadumi, for example, who's Nigerian based in the United States. Heide mentions key principles of what she says are modern matriarchies. She says these are concrete rather than abstract, so it lives in the societies we come from. It's not mother rule, as in the antithesis or the opposite of patriarchy, but it's non-hierarchical. It's based on consensus and unanimity, usually systems of councils like the Iroquois and grandmothers' councils and so on. It's grassroots, it's consultative, participatory, democratic. These are all in brief. We can examine it more closely later. Distribution in sharing rather than accumulation and hoarding, close to Genevieve Vaughan's heart in relation to the gift paradigm. It meets needs rather than the idea of power over. There is space for motherly or matriarchal man, like the handsome fellow at the back. A humane society is the emphasis. It's radically oriented towards life rather than the war industry. Political action is always spiritual in matriarchy versus the detachment in patriarchy. All are connected, science, politics, spirituality, all ad infinitum. Okay? So that's just the essential elements in a nutshell of modern matriarchal societies. If we look at African matrilineal or matriarchal societies, they are across the continent. There's a list, Angola, Botswana, all the way to the country known as North Africa, which my colleague over there, Malika Grassov, has spent a lot of time. That's meant to be funny, the country called North Africa. Southeast, Northwest. The same is true for every continent, really every continent. Just Google it. So we need to rematriate knowledge and practices. But these matriarchal societies that we come from are ordinary and everyday. It's unfortunate that most people just have not learned about it in school. So Amadumi speaks, my auntie Amadumi, who's now in her 60s, speaks of matriarchitarianism. It's a new concept, but it's the same in essence. She speaks of the necessity for feminist indigenous scholarship to be interdisciplinary and intersectional, like feminist indigenous theories. It should, though, include spirituality, and she insists and she asserts it should include prophecy. This is exciting, this is new, because it includes our shamanic or our indigenous spiritual practices. So she rematriates, or as Jen would say, matriates, the concept of the traditional in Africa to mean pre-colonial African cultures that are not static or delineated by rigid time breaks. This rematriate traditional is dynamic, past, present, and may, I would say, include future, especially if we're talking prophecy. So Amadubi says matriarchy is the matricentric unit, as the is the smallest kinship unit. Its material basis is concrete and empirical, while the material and ideological basis of patriarchy embodies a contradiction. Surprise. Patriarchy is disputable, she says, since fatherhood is a social construct. Amadubi says matriarchitarianism captures a woman-generated inclusive culture in the indigenous social structure as a movement. And this is the exciting part of it. She roots it in the movement, in action, in transformation, in change, in hope. Remaking activism back to our center, our core, our African calabash, or indeed, for some of you, your European chalice. Amadumi, for me, speaks of collective kinship, like the Pan-African concept of Ubuntu. She speaks of poetry. She is a poet. And for me, she speaks with love. It's this collective kinship and love, compassion, gifting, trust, respect, on which indigenous and Khoisan values are based. It grounds our structures as egalitarian and nonviolent, the two very interdependent, one can't exist without the other. This then for me is the praxis rather than theory, as Einstein would say, of everything, of love especially, Khoisan style. On the right is Ma Meneputo. She's a very indeterminably old and wise San healer in the Kalahari. In the Kalahari Desert spans six Southern African countries. And she says, the San people found power in the light of the moon. The ancients made a queen and hoisted her up into the sky where she became the moon. The people danced in the light of the moon. This is where we found and find our healing power. If you look, and this is all about decolonizing and rematriation, at the bottom right you'll see an ancient rock art figure. European anthropologists, patriarchal largely, say it's a man because they think in the middle between the two legs is a phallus. It's not a phallus, it's a loincloth. So we have to argue and fight with the people who control the discourse of our very own ancestry, our history, our everything. On the other side, going clockwise, is two women. They are a couple. The one of the two women had a male partner, but they've been known each other since they were little. They live in the Kalahari, deep rural Kalahari, and one of the two, the taller one, had a male partner and made babies. When the male partner passed, she moved back in with the little one, and they lived together quietly. But indeed, if you want to use Western terms, they are romantic partners. And there's nothing extraordinary about it. It's just arbitrary and ordinary. There is space for everybody, for every articulation of love, there's respect, and it's all okay. So social structure and social values are interdependent. Egalitarianism crosses all those so-called categories, social, gender, generational, sexualities, all ad infinitum. Madumi uses the gender neutral Nigerian Igbo term ya. And people speak about the European imposition of gendered concepts across society, such as a male human being or humanity as the norm, like the rights of man, or even a male god, as in monotheistic patriarchal religions like Christianity. Essential elements are non-violence or peace. Those are critical essential elements, gifting, love, compassion, trust, respect, always with women and motherers, as Genevieve has just taught me a new term, motherers, at the center. For our European allies, I say do not despair. There's always hope for y'all. We feel very sorry for you. But don't despair. I'm kidding, right? I'm full of jokes. I'm not just a poet, I'm a comic as well. For our European allies, we say banish fear. Own your power and your privilege, but claim your agency. You should, though, skip shame and guilt. My colleague Peter Foss, a constitutional law professor in Cape Town, says, skip shame and guilt, because that's too disempowering. Instead, find concrete ways to act as an ally. Try not to take up so much physical, emotional, spiritual, psychic, intellectual space. And the corollary is the way we feminists look at the way dudes take up spaces in our universities, in our public spaces, indeed in our homes. So if we as feminists, even the South Africans take up a lot of space in the rest of Africa and other places. So we should be conscious of these kinds of things. We need to rematriate, and you all need to rematriate your own ancient knowledge and practices as women-centered, like Genevieve and others do. And instead of gawking at Native women as exotic and idle, instead of going off to study the Khasi, go to Cyprus and look at your own origins. Does it make sense? Mm-hmm. Redistribute. This is very important to me. None of this is good. All the intentions and love in the world is great and wonderful and beautiful. But it's quite, you know, not enough, because we need redistribution. Remember the vast continent of Africa. All the minerals are being extracted from there. The conflict in Central Africa is fueled arguably by the mineral extraction, resource extraction there. So we need to redistribute ill-gotten patriarchal colonial capitalist gains. That's very critical. We need to give back. And then finally, don't lose hope. Keep faith, I argue. Change is not only possible, it's inevitable. So to conclude, rematriation of indigenous knowledge and practice and love, which is essential. How the questions we asked and dealt with and will continue to grapple with is how we reclaim our ancestral remains, some of which are still in museums around the world, our spirituality and our culture as woman-centered and woman-sacred, knowledge and resources, healing and medicinal knowledge, for example, how we return to Mother Earth, to our origins, to life and co-creation. How do we rematriate germination rather than semination?
How do we give birth to new movements of decolonized feminists? How do we decolonize and rematriate love? That is our panel. We will now open the floor to discussion. Open-ended, if you want. And please don't leave, because at the end of our session, we have our collective via our beautiful sister from Colombia. We have a gift for you, because we practice, we walk our talk. So anybody want to comment? questions? How do you feel about it? And if you prefer to draw, we have crayons and markers for you.
It is rematriate germination.
Germination is the way a seed goes like so.
Yes.
Versus semination, when you make ejaculation from the penis.
Ah oui, donc tu fais la germination.
Ah oui. The feminine rather than the... Sorry.
How can I make this? Germination. That example. Give me some example.
Edit. You remember the whole panel was about rematriate germination. She wants to know how we're going to make it. Should we address them? Malika is our comrade, our sister. She's part of our family of matriarchal studies and the feminist of Tibet.
It's okay, but it is really interesting to.
Please feel free to discuss. Have your questions or comments? Do you think it's nonsense? Do you find it exciting? Do you want to draw, do a poem? You have, ma'am? Oh, yeah.
It's a good way to start to deconstruct the systems that we're living in right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could incorporate it into education, like from a young age, these practices, then that would be good. I like it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's new and exciting.
Mm-hmm. Oh. We greatly moved. We deeply relieved that you found it exciting. Were you going to say something? Does anybody
want to say
something? Am I intimidating?
No. Do you sort of consider yourselves ecofeminists? Also, what do you feel about ecofeminism? Is there a connection?
Of course, there has to be. All our relatives, Native Americans say all my relatives, and that includes absolutely everything that's from the mother. And if we're all from the mother, how can we not care about our mother? We can't keep scalping her. We look at the industrialists and the pollution, we say that they're scalping Mother Earth, which is obviously a very bad thing to do. How could it not be part? I'm not even sure I understand the question.
No, ecofeminisms are a very critical part of remediation, of the way we use it.
Yes.
It's, how to put it, related very closely, like twins, but more with,
But ecofeminism don't mean automatically with mother.
Neither mother.
It is with the environment, with the natural, with the ecosystem, but not automatically with the motherhood, with mother.
And things like Amajumi's prophecy, which helps us, to... So that's the way that we don't separate our spirituality so much, the extent of prophecy from the rest of our work.
Yes, I think that's interesting, because we do that automatically. I never even thought about that as a theory until she pointed out.
So you can teach a class, do a workshop, go into a trance, write a book, make a poem, do artwork, be clumsy like me, everything, make love, all of it at the same time.
Germination.
Indeed.
Yes, I think it is very interesting, but the concepts of germination are very different with people, with each people, with each person.
In front of Mechthild and then Mechthild.
Do you see for men in a society which is based on rematriating love? You talked a little bit about the role, the connections between ecofeminism and rematriation, and do you see a danger of focusing so much on women's responsibility, that they might say, well, like, the if you want to save Earth, it's all women's responsibility. Like, if since it's about Mother Earth, like, what role do you see for women, for men in a society based on rematriation?
That's such an important question you raise. I'm going to ask other people to respond, because, of course, I have a lot to say, so I'm going to be quiet now and let everybody else respond. Who wants to go first?
Okay. I can say that I think that with the gift economy and with restoring the mother and the recognizing that you have been mothered and using that as a model, then men can be mothers too, in the sense of they are also the products of mothers, and we need to generalize this model of mothering to men as well as to women.
And I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel here. You know, we have the list of all the, she had a list up there, and we've been talking, you know, cultures that have been going on for thousands of years, quite successfully, thank you, before the Europeans arrived, were matriarchal in structure, and obviously men existed in them, and we know very well the way the roles of men and women go together. Very first thing you do is stop focusing on marriage and start focusing on brother. What we have, the primary relationship is mother-daughter. Next one is sister-sister, then you've got sister-brother. The male-female relationship is not to a husband. He's incidental, as I think Valentine said. The major relationship is to the brother and to the mother's brother, the uncle. And when you start with those models, you wind up with a very different view of who men are and how they relate, but it's very essential that I have a brother, that I have a maternal uncle. And that just resets what men are and how they relate to and how they take their identity. And once you start down that road, you'd be surprised how much things pop themselves into place.
For example, the Dagara in Burkina Faso, West Africa, they refer to the male mother, which is the mother's brother, and he fulfills huge, significant nurturing in very powerful and particular ways, especially with male children and when they're in trouble, for example. So but why we so emphasize the woman-centered, woman-sacred is because of patriarchy that's completely eroded, and even in matriarchal peoples continues, and Christianity continues to erode that, okay? So we're just trying to rebalance. Mishka?
I finished a course, teaching a new course for the first time, and I read a lot of things I wasn't speaking of.
Right,
oh, I feel like I'm shouting. Okay, let me speak more loudly. One of the things I have learned to rethink the image of Mother Earth, which is also in the organic, organismic worldview, a European image, which then was, of course, destroyed, became the mechanistic. So there's also a European tradition. I'm from Germany, so I speak from a European background, which is very different from what it then developed into. But what I want to say is there are new developments. The ecofeminism is one of the issues. I want to see how mothering, when you look at it as in terms of care, you care for the human, the non-human, the other than human, the more than human, the earth others, it is automatically included. So it is not, it's so, and then there is also the other image is the other development in the ecofeminist community, that if you look at Mother Earth and this image of the big mother taking care of all the creatures, however, and I know indigenous communities know that very well, the earth is also rather destructive. She can be very wild. She can be very threatening. And we have a way, we have to not only care for her, but we take from her, we give back in order to care for her. We also have to respect her or it for its own being, of being wild sometimes and destroying things. And we need to not only see how we recuperate, how we, so it's also a kind of a more, they call it now, there's one movement that says we need to have a partnership ethic with nature. And they've used the term partnership, it's more it's not the mother-child of one is in need and the other one gives, but it's also shifts it to a more of an equal. I don't know, equal, I don't like the word, the term, their own being, and to respect each other. So I just want to throw this out as a way of developing our thinking from this Mother Earth image and the mothering, and see how it can be branch out and include ways of thinking that make it more inclusive of, that automatically include ecofeminism.
Okay. It was with responsibility.
Yeah.
Avec la responsabilité.
Right.
It's very important. It was the term. The responsibility is more than only mother and the child.
Yeah.
It is a responsibility, not only respect. You can have respect, but not responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the dimension.
Thanks. Jen wants to respond as
well. Well, I don't think that the image of Mother Earth does not necessarily make us into children. The image of mothers doesn't require us to be less than. There's already a sense in which the mother recognizes a child's need to be independent, and so she doesn't satisfy the needs all the time, and in which the child can give to the mother as well as being given to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an interaction already when you have mothers and children, and you can also project this power structure of mother over onto Mother Earth, but you don't have to. It can be already an egalitarian.
We have a very strong concept of taking care of the Earth. She's our mother, you take care of her. For example, mound building was construed as taking care of the mother. And if we had a ceremony, one of the things we'd do, because, you know, mother can get forgetful sometimes, is if you've got a ceremony, for example, replicating patterns of stars, we would do that sort of thing, and you put the stake in the ground and you replicate a certain pattern of star. You left that there in case she forgot what happened. She will remember what happened, so you would cover up those stakes with the mound, and then she would always remember what happened in that particular place. You know, that's earth writing. Mounds are earth writing. So that idea that mother is in a hierarchical sense is really not part of the thinking. Actually, when we give thanks to the spirits, they're giving thanks back to us. It's not just that one-way kind of a street, and if you think of it as a dead end, you know, give thanks in the dead end, like I've seen so many Christians do, that's a very strange idea, because there's always a reciprocation that's going on there. It's not about hierarchy at all. It's kind of a puzzling thought.
When one of the places to rematriate is within Christianity, even, and I think that's something that it gets really easy to say Christianity,
mm-hmm.
but it's a plural, and I think that's really important to just kind of hold in attention,
mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of mothering image throughout the scripture tradition, but then also through the lived tradition.
Certainly.
And you know, if you look at Celtic Christianity, it's a profoundly female tradition. Now, patriarchy has, you know, buried that, but you know, part of, I think, you know, when I sort of read the title, the Rematriating Western Ways, like there's so much within Christianity even that can and needs to be claimed, reclaimed, transformed, you know, rebirthed in very similar ways in order to really understand some of the gifts within that tradition as well.
Are you talking about the Marianist tradition?
No, I mean, I think the Mary tradition is really interesting, and I think there's lots that can be done with that, but I think because Christianity very quickly moved into a power position within the Roman Empire, it moved very quickly into a patriarchal system. And I think if you actually go back into the scripture and into the stories, there's actually a lot more about women and the empowerment of women in some of the original stories than has been passed down in the tradition. And I think there's real opportunity there. Like when talking about, you know, sort of reclaiming the spirituality and the culture and women-centered, women-sacred, like there's lots within Christianity and the way women have lived Christianity. That may not be in the mainstream, that may not be the way it's traditionally thought of, but there's lots in there that can also be thought through and
of course.
Re-germinated.
Of course. If it's appropriate for your path and if that's where you're located, then absolutely we support rematriation.
Mm-hmm.
But as indigenous peoples, we'd want to rematriate our original our knowledge, our original spirituality,
mm-hmm.
which has been encroached by Christianity.
Yes.
Questions, comments? More poems?
Yes, more poems.
But it was an important thing you raised, because everybody has their work in their society, and Valentina wants to say something.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to do some dancing. Cassie dancing. Please, Angela Dovich.
On the subject of rematriation of the pre-Columbian, I mean the pre-Columbian inhabitants, the ones that live in this continent, but you know, mostly we know about them because of the Incas and the Mayas and the Aztecs, but they were other groups. Basically, what we seem to remember is that they were warriors, you know, that they were patriarchal cultures, because that is what we have extracted mm-hmm. from these cultures. But basically, there were quite a few who were matriarchal cultures. And one of the things which I have here, and which is interesting, is that some of these, you know, like the Dorado culture, if you like, seem to be matriarchal, except that the only thing that was recovered and that seems to appear was the symbols that got to be with patriarchy. For instance, this culture, which you are going to receive one of these, it was a matriarchal culture, and it was only discovered 17 years ago. And what it appears, you see here that this is a birth. This is, you know, this is the birth of a child.
Yes.
And since the only thing that remains of this culture is either their gold-plated pectorals or the gold pieces or the ceramics, I mean, there's nothing written at all. So it just simply was left very much to interpretation of what things were. So sometimes you call, for instance, that some of the few were anthropomorphic. What does it mean? That they are not females or males or anything like that. But nobody has really gone into it and see that basically quite a lot of these things, especially in certain cultures, they were female, and that they were matriarchal cultures, except that nobody has gone into exploring this.
Do you want to pass around your generous gift from...
I want to give it?
Yeah, just pass it around to people. Thank you. Angela Domich brought us this gift
from
Colombia.
Look in it and see that it's the birth of a child.
It's a deed about germination and remating germination.
And Angela represents Echo Nashira.
Yeah.
Tell us, it's a woman-centered Echo Village.
Mother-centered, woman-centered Echo Village. Is that correct? And she'll tell us about it tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Can I say something?
I see Frieda Wergen's hand is up, and
yes.
I see Linda Ruffman's up.
I just,
between the two of you,
just real quick. I just wanted to say, Angela, that the image that is on this, you gave me one this morning at breakfast. And then when I was watching Malika's slideshow in a previous session today, and she was showing pottery that had this M design, and when I saw that, I thought that M design, that same M design, is on these on this from South America and from
yes.
from the North Africa, right?
Mm.
And it is, and the M you said was the open legs of the mother, and also the legs of the male, and this has the M design for the legs also in the birth-giving mother. So it's universal, isn't it?
Yes.
It's everywhere.
You have these symbols in the mantra, lessons. In the
mantra,
really? You learn. Yes.
Huh.
It is a very beautiful book about Jill Peirce. And Jill Peirce, Jill Peirce,
mm-hmm.
P-O-U-R-C-E. And she described this power with the mantra, with the spiral, etc.
Oh.
It's an interesting. Mm-hmm. This to me. This.
Valentina requested the site of Table Mountain, sorry.
Valentina?
It's interesting, since that's up there, I have a second question, but it's interesting how, it really is interesting how we don't look at nature anymore in a certain sense for beauty, and if we do, we see it as beautiful if we can recreate it mechanically. And it's basically this appropriation of the world that we're sort of dealing with here. What I wanted to ask Barbara, I found your thing very, very interesting. And how do Aboriginal peoples deal with lying and killing? In other words, are there, in terms of dealing with that violation in their own cultures?
Well, we don't think that murder is a good idea.
I certainly wasn't expecting that.
we have wampum for this. There's a lot of different uses of wampum. It's a writing system, by the way. But wampum also contains thoughts and images and spirit that you can give away. And so there are wampum for the condolence council. And part condolence council is way too complicated to try and explain here, but it's a way of putting right things that went very, very wrong. And part of the condolence council is in case that when somebody dies, you condole the relatives. In case that occurred by murder, there is something called 20 matters, and that's 20 wampum. And that 20 wampum is a gift of great restoration that's given to the family of the murdered individual. And on top of that, that restoration, all that spirit that you're handing over, wampum is beads made out of the quahog shell. They are, it's called black, but it's actually purple, like your shirt there, and white, mother of pearl. And so you have the beads of those different colors, and there are different strings that mean different things. Different things are written on them. But there's a special set of wampum in case it was murder, and that's the 20 matters, 20 wampum. But if it was a man who was killed, there's also a fine of 10 extra wampum. If it's a woman that was killed, there's 20 extra. Women are considered twice as valuable as men for a lot of different reasons. So that 20 wampum goes to the family. And that is considered to make it right. The family can ask for a penalty if it wants, but that's up to them. So there's wampum in case there's murder. There is no lie wampum. There's no wampum to make a lie right. It just destroys everything. You cannot make it right. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're asking, what do we do about murder? Well, that's what we did about murder, about lies. That just was not part of the culture. I mean, how can you have an ancient tradition of making lies right when lies was just not part of the culture? You know, what happens if somebody lies? I think the Europeans have a story about a little boy in Holland, right, that kept saying something like the wolf is coming. Oh, maybe, I don't know what a little boy was, but he kept saying, wolf's coming. Nobody believed him because he thought it was funny. And then one day he said the wolf was coming because the wolf was coming. Nobody believed him, then the wolf came and ate everybody up. Okay. So just think about the culture. What happens to the culture if somebody thinks it's really funny to say a tornado's coming and it's not? The culture is going to fall apart. It's not going to continue. And we deliberately killed smaller bases. We deliberately had smaller towns. We could have had towns of a couple million, like, as we did in Central America, but we deliberately didn't have more than 15,000 people in a town so that you could physically, personally know every single individual and measure that person's quality and know about that person. And that's part of the trust thing. When I think that lying becomes more possible when you have larger and larger groups, large enough that you can have anonymity. I think that's when lying starts. So we deliberately kept it small, and we didn't have to deal with lies until the Europeans came. And then we're still kind of flat-footed about Lars. We still don't quite know what the heck to do about that. We really don't. There's no wampum to lie.
Mom and Aputo, I want to three quick things. One is the city I come from, Cape Town, is called the Mother City. It's very powerful because it's where people refer to it as the womb, the nurturing, whatever the mother. The other one is Mom and Aputo, the healer from the Kalahari. Her husband is the one that holds the space for her. He, in fact, nurtures her and takes care of her while she does the healing and goes into trance and does things, and he holds the space for her, gives her water, brings her out gently, all that. And that's a very powerful example. That same woman hunts from childhood. She's been hunting, and she makes beads and dolls, so she does everything. And they share roles, so it's egalitarian. And finally, she recounts a story, where an old story where during the colonization of Southern Africa by Nguni peoples from East Africa, there was conflict of resources, and San people went and stole one Xhosa man's cattle. And the Xhosa people came and took the San little boy as a slave. And off he went for many years. He lived with them. And then at the time the boy was in his teens, his clan went to the Xhosa family and said, "You have now had him for so long. We have now repaired the damage of stealing the cattle or retaking the cattle. So can we have our child back?" In the meanwhile, the boy had been sharing knowledge, local indigenous knowledge around healing herbs and so on, and terrain, etc., with the guests, the Xhosa people who had come in. And so after this time of reparation, it was a gifting all in many different ways, and the boy was allowed to return to his family. That is one example of alternative ways of handling so-called justice. I wonder if there are any urgent questions or comments that people would like to make, or if people would like us to close the session. And if anybody has a stick that they want to insert, then you have one and we'll take it. No more questions, no more comments.
Yes, I
want. Hold it.
Can we say something about the session that's coming up tomorrow?
Yes. Oh, yes. Who wants to go? Jen.
Tomorrow we have two sessions in the morning from 9 to 12:30, and there'll be eight of us talking about the gift economy, maternal economy as an alternative to patriarchal capitalism.
Very good.
And it runs one on to the other.
Which room?
Démarré 10-1061.
And we want to thank especially the people for participating, but the volunteers as well. You all
are incredible,
all of you, making it an experience for us.
The young women of the country.